to Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host of the All About Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined this evening by Adam Camilleri.
Everyone go to their sheds, crack out your leaf blower, it's mech time.
And Red Powell.
Good evening.
What's going on, guys?
Exciting. I say this every episode, but man, they are managing to keep my hype at record levels.
Yeah.
They're doing an excellent job.
So coming up on this show, we have a very special community spotlight segment. I think you want to tune in. It's about women in war games. Next week, there's going to be some exciting things, and I think I can mention maybe one of those things. We'll be having a chat with Dan Abnett, the man.
The famous, probably one of the most well-known authors of G-Dub books that I know of. Maybe ADB's up there as one of an equal stature, but man, for as long as I can remember, he's been writing the best stuff I can read.
He's broken into comic books and stuff too, so I hope to spend some time talking with him about the comic books in addition to the 40K and Horus Heresy novels. It's scheduled on the books. We're going to do it, and we're going to bring you that content. I hope I didn't jinx it, but it is coming. Yeah, there's going to be some big content coming in the next couple of weeks. Like I mentioned, wanted to give a little teaser. It's going to be delivered.
Yeah, man. With ninth being launched. If you think we can talk now, everybody just hold up. Wait a month and watch like the deluge spew forth from us.
Well, a couple things we've been asked, you know, where's some of the content reviews on the other books that have come out, you know, the Engine Wars and the Psychic Awakening things, and I think that's all going to be coming. We just want to make sure it's within the context of, you know, what you're going to be playing with, what armies you should be building towards or could be building towards.
I mean, as soon as ninth edition got announced, like all that stuff kind of got, well, it lost its frame of reference. We could go through that stuff and tell you what's good and, you know, what's the things in there that are always going to be good. But those are things that you could see for yourself. Like anybody could crack open that book and know that Cataphron Breaches and Destroyers with 5+ Feel No Pain is phenomenally strong. Still, you don't need us to tell you that. Yeah. Exactly right. You don't need us to tell you that. But the fringe stuff, the interesting stuff, the juicy bits, those things don't have a frame of reference yet. They need some context from 9th edition before we can be like, okay, here's the stuff that's really been shaken up, that's really changed. Here's the stuff that's turned on its head.
Yeah, because there's a lot of good stuff. There really is. And there's a lot of momentum to it. But I agree with you, Adam, that it's you could talk about it now, but you're going to have to re-talk about it in certain regards, especially with some of the interesting dynamic changes that are coming in with 9th edition.
Well, you know, again, hopefully we get to talk about that stuff coming up in the, you know, who knows when. But I mentioned that I've been building all those Scorpus Dune Riders and the Disintegrators and stuff. And I think I forgot to mention one of my favorite things about this kit is that I've now accumulated quite the collection of Adeptus Mechanicus transfers.
I don't think I've ever seen one of the transfer sheets. So I was about to say, what's even on it?
They are freaking amazing. Whereas the Space Marine transfers and stuff, I use them a lot more sparingly. Like I may, you know, bring in a chapter decal or an occasional number or something or whatever. The AdMech Adeptus Mechanicus transfer sheet is chock full of really cool things that, you know, interesting Adeptus Mechanicus graphics, little squad symbols, things that you can use in various configurations, like turning triangles one way or another to represent squad markings. And it's got some, you know, little script and stuff on it. It is, I don't know, I think it's one of the better like small size, medium size transfer sheets that they put out.
I'm still in awe of some of the Forge World transfers. If anybody,
oh yeah, they're paintings, man. They're absolutely amazing. Worth it. If you are an opportunity to pick them up, and you're trying to do a banner or something, and just like freehand or, you know, not your style, you got one of those old flat banners without the reliefs on them. Go for it.
Question for you, Paul. Can you recognize the different like iconographies of Forge Worlds? Like, I'm assuming they would have Mars and maybe Riser or Lucius on that transfer sheet. Can you identify? I have no idea what their symbols are.
No earthly idea.
That is so interesting.
The Riser one looks, it is very, it's the Imperial like R essentially. But like
good old Imperial R.
Yeah, yeah. Like that's I just know that one because I've seen enough Riser, and a good friend of mine, Damien, he has painted a ton of Riza, and he was actually on a mad hunt. Some of those decals, those transfers, can be hard to find sometimes. And so, I mean, I'm sure they're coming back into into the swing of it, but at a time they were once hard to get a hold of, and so I remember him looking for that, and he was looking specifically for that, and so I've become slightly familiar in searching for some of those symbols. But yeah, they totally have them. They get used.
I mean, these decals or transfers get used, and I think that's why they're a little bit shorter supply. I mean, obviously, you know, they probably get purchased less than marine kits, but people, if you have them, you will use them, I think, or they're worth using.
I agree.
Some really interesting stuff has come out. It laced into the faction focus articles on the Warhammer community site. The thing that everyone has been talking about is unit coherency.
I'm going to put it out there. This is the first thing that they've put out that I'm not super on board with. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's going to be bad, but I haven't been jumping for joy at this change.
Yeah, so this is where it gets tricky, all right? A unit that has more than one model must be set up and finish any sort of move as a single group with all models within 2 inches horizontally and 5 inches vertically of at least one other model from their unit. While a unit has 6 or more models, all models must instead be within 2 inches horizontally and 5 inches vertically of at least 2 other models from their unit. This is unit coherency.
So that's an obvious fix to the kind of tendrilling we were seeing for, I guess, a lot of this edition. Where I've done it a lot, where I've had one unit of just 10 guardsmen, sometimes on up to 3 objectives, possibly at like max coherency.
Yeah, you're creating these spokes in a wheel almost. Yeah. You got these unit spokes, you know, trail all back to a character, or they're between two different objectives. We even talked about on the last show about stringing out to 3 or more objectives sometimes.
Mm. This bit right here, I think is a great change. I think it's a great, I guess, a thematic gameplay element that I think adds a lot to how the game will look visually and how it will feel. It won't feel like you're just getting dominated by literally one unit on the table is dominating the entire board. I don't feel like that's a representation of, I feel like what I would like the game to look aesthetically. I'm sure people have different preferences on that. But where I get a little bit of a weird bit about is the next part, Paul, if you've got that available.
Yeah, it goes on to talk about how you can't make any kind of move if you can't end in coherency. And then it mentions that, yeah, you move in the movement phase, but you also move in the charge and the fight phase. So those are important distinctions. And then it goes on to say that the unit coherency check, at the end of the morale phase, I'm assuming here, each player must now remove models one at a time from any units in their armies that are no longer in unit coherency as defined on page 198. We don't know reference of that yet. Until only a single group of models from the unit remains in play and in unit coherency. The models removed count as having been destroyed, but they never trigger any rules that are used when the model is destroyed. Models removed because of this do not cause their unit to take another morale test.
Mm. So this is done after morale, yeah?
That's the context from what I'm getting from the currency check about don't cause you to take another morale check. So you remove models from your units in your army that are not in unit coherency. Once all out of coherency models have been removed, if any, the morale phase ends. The player's turn ends, and unless the battle ends, the next player's turn begins. So if you've got that string of models, and something causes you to remove 3 or 4 models in the middle of that string, because everyone's like, oh, we'll just have a string and then we'll close the loops like we've got bow ties or whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
And now we've got this extra coherency check that says if you remove those models in the middle and then they're no longer in coherency, you've got to remove some number of models to create that bubble of ones that are do satisfy the coherency.
So in practical terms, think about how far you could stretch out, say, 30 termagants. Now, you could do the same thing now and stretch virtually almost exactly the same length, but just tie the ends off and then run the risk of having horrible like repercussions should you lose a chunk of them. Or you can just double line. So you've got to halve the amount of distance you can cover and just do 2 rows. So you've got little blocks of 4, essentially, all two inches apart. And that gets around most of the issues. So this is just a gut feel. This is pure. I can't say this with any significant anything. But this and the way this thing is worded bothers me because it's got the feel of a gotcha. It's got the feel of something that could be weaponized against me.
Here's the deal, though. Yes, it can, but you would have done it to yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
But you
absolutely
will do it would've. To yourself. That's the gotcha.
You will. You will. I agree 100% in that it is. So what you're looking at, you know, we've seen, just like you were saying, Adam, you know, 30 termagants stretched out. And then you talk about, you know, tying it off at the end and putting like a little cluster, I'll call them, you know, little triangles, right? I can see it as triangles, like what you're talking about with like the blocks of 2 by 2 by 2. I think you could actually get away with doing triangles in it. And what you're looking at, yep, is almost like formations, right? And I mean, you have like formations of these models and how you put them out. And it's going to be interesting to see, to your point, Adam, there about the gotcha point, as people are starting to remove the models, it is absolutely, like Paul said, on you, the player, as you remove those pieces. There's only, you know, one exception to that, and I'll get to that in a second, but like you're going to put yourself in your own bind there. You really have to commit one way or the other, whereas we used to not have to. We just wait till the movement phase for the most part and then just move back into coherency. The only time that this is no longer, you know, that it's out of your hand is some of these targeted abilities, which are far and few between, very far and few. Like what immediately came to mind for me was the Death Jester, the ability to pick a model out, right?
Yeah. Do you think
that is so powerful now?
Do you think, guys think this incentivizes going second or therefore going last in a tournament or in a game to be able to not care about this in the last turn?
I think it does, absolutely. And on top of that, I think with a lot of the way scoring is getting done at the moment, at least in the, well, I shouldn't say scoring is getting done at the moment, with the mission that they've shown us, and with the tidbits that they've dropped saying, you know, things are going to be of the same ilk as this mission, et cetera, et cetera, where scoring is done at the start of your next turn. So you have to hold through your opponent's turn and stuff like that. Being going on the second turn, it's not as the detriment as it was, where people could, you know, first turn, people could run up and grab 5 or 6 maelstrom points and then, I think I'm stuffed. No matter what you do, your opponent gets to respond to your placement stuff. So going second, plus this, I think, is only a bonus, only a boon.
There you go. Well, I mean, this is a big change. We're used to moving models a certain way, and now we're going to have to change that. And this spiraling or tendriling and concept has been in place for a long time, essentially since, I don't know, the first custom force field.
Yeah, that's actually really probably very apt. I suppose the reason it gives me cause for concern is that it feels like they're replacing what was probably, from their point of view, a feels bad or a concerning mechanic with another feels bad and possibly concerning mechanic. Does that make sense?
It does. That may be just, I don't know, since we haven't played with it yet, slightly. I mean.
Oh, yeah, look, I've got nothing to base this opinion on.
Yeah.
I'm just reading it being like, huh, that's going to come to bite me at some point. I can already feel it. I can already feel my blood being like.
I don't disagree with you. That's my trepidation for even mentioning it. Is like, I don't disagree. I think it's a little bit premature to assign, you know, a feel bad thing to it. Mm. And if that's the hardest thing we have to deal with is moving our models or moving our large units in tighter clusters, then maybe that's not so bad.
This is probably the way I see this. If this is going to be weaponized brutally on a competitive level, and probably this is unethical. But let's say you've got an Imperial Knight, or you've got something that you can make auto explode. Yeah, top of turn one, you drive it into your opponent's army, and you make it explode, and then tap the chest clock onto them. And so now you're putting a huge amount of pressure on them to resolve 6 or 7 bits of mortal wounds while maintaining coherency right in the middle of their lines. I can just see that being like. I just see that being like, oh, wow, I just lost half an hour.
You've already fringe cased yourself into 3 different scenarios there. I think
exactly right.
I think you'd be all right. I think we're going to be all right.
Look, I think it'd be all right. But when I was thinking about it, I'm like, how?
I need to play Nurgle, though, is what you said. That's what I heard from that. Is Death Guard are coming back.
Well, I was thinking like a Knight Gallant with Landstrider, just like heat-seeking missile that right down your opponent's throat, top of turn one, on a shorter board. And it's like, yeah!
Or maybe
tap that chest clock.
Maybe we finally get a stomper.
It's the day. It is the time of the stomper. Because nothing's going to have a bigger footprint, is it? The explosion is going to reach into like the next table, the next dimension. They're going to feel that explosion in the warp.
God, how awesome would it be to pick apart just enough of everyone's unit to where they all evaporated because of unit coherency from the stomper? From that 9,000 point investment you made into the stomper.
What is it now? Is it 700 points or something now?
I think it's 850. I mean, if it's a single one, I mean, whatever it is. I mean, it hasn't changed. I mean, at least I'm not aware of any updates to Stompa points.
So yuck.
Hey, I think we just found another fringe case for it.
Let's do it. Yeah. Somebody make that happen. Val, your time to shine.
Yeah. So, but this unit coherency, I mean, it is, it's big. It's something that we haven't had to contend with tactically, I mean, in any meaningful way in forever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So in 7th edition, the only time coherency became a thing for me was when people tried to block me when I did hit and run in 7th edition. They were trying to block my hit and run by breaking coherency and using, you know, pincering models and stuff like that. Essentially, it was like what tri-pointing evolved into for 8th edition. But for now, coherency was like, I've got these 30 conscripts. They're on 2 objectives. I really don't need them to move for the rest of the game. So I can pick up all these casualties in the middle, the string, and just leave the 2 blobs of like 5 or 6 guys on each objective. Doesn't matter. I'll just auto-pass them because I'm getting like 4 points a turn out of them. Like, so coherency wasn't a big deal if you didn't need to do anything with the unit.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a meaningful change that once we get past these reservations that we're voicing now, it's good that we're talking through it, that it's going to be, I don't know that we'll appreciate it, but I think we'll appreciate it like either subconsciously more than we have what you just described. You know, these ludicrous situations to where we've removed all narrative element from this unit that we purchased together, we know functions is supposed to function as a solid thing, and just turned it into a point scoring mechanism. Mm.
I still think aesthetically, I like this change more than I dislike it. It's the first time I've been like, huh, I can already envision the frustration I'm going to have one day. Like in one game, I'm like, oh, you were going to screw yourself over so badly, Adam, one time.
Yeah, no, I know it's happening to me. Like, my guard formations are, you know, we're talking about, like, now, heck, I was even advocating, like, we don't know that Horde's going to be different. Now, it's not going to be like this, maybe the green tide is going to be, I don't know, a bunch of green bowling balls rolling across.
No, I mean, for real, right? Like, it's changing the way that, like, you know, like you said, Adam, from 7th edition and before that, like, we're really having to approach the game in a different way as taking AdMech or Dark Eldar or whoever, you know, that ability, some of them have the ability to move over units and cause mortal wounds in the movement phase. And then you go into the psyker phase, you cause more wounds to a unit. And then you go to the player has to be aware of where they're pulling these models from all the way up until the morale phase at this point. And so you really just need to get in the habit sooner than later of just pulling organically from the unit so that you're not setting yourself up for failure.
They'll get an element of muscle memory to this, like, especially when you know your units, what you're using them for, why they exist in your list, like, and you'll understand where you can pull and like safely do so, especially, and you'll get a read of the board. Like, I don't think if this thing is an issue, I don't think it'd be an issue for very long. Cause I do just think people who play 40K are pretty adaptable, especially rules wise with the roller coasters we've had in the last like 3 years. This is just the next in a long string of things. But I actually have a question for you, Red. So for those of you who don't know, our man Red here has been promoted. What do we now need to address you as?
Major power. Thanks, Adam. No, I was recently promoted. I am officially a major rank now. Thank you.
Have you in like, let's say in war games, training, practice, or real life, whatever, have you seen anyone ever in real terms like employ the tendril method to win a battle?
So
how far does the octopus get
stretching those supply chain logistics?
No. So interestingly enough, like in real world formations and everything, right? Dispersion is a huge deal. If you go and you see some of the video footage of even like Desert Storm, you can get some of the pictures of them where they're spread out, but a lot of the footage, you know, looks cool and everything where they capture like tanks moving and they're within 300 yards of each other. But in reality, I mean, we want hundreds of meters between this, and we're talking, I mean, very good dispersion, because you don't want someone to be able to acquire a target. So it's kind of interesting in regards of cohesion. And, you know, if you've got a radio and you kind of see it with the guard, you know, they don't necessarily, if they have a Vox communicator, they don't have to be like right on top of each other to be able to give orders, or at least it has worked like that at one point. You know, in the real world with communication systems and everything that we have, we're able to disperse quite a bit. And so when you're looking at a map, it's actually kind of interesting how far out units can be. But the other thing is that if you're, you know, if you don't anticipate the enemy correctly on a given flank or something, and you've spread yourself out too much, I mean, an entire flank can collapse because the enemy just comes at it full bore from one angle or another, and you've dispersed yourself so much that you don't have mutually supporting fires to be able to engage effectively because you didn't I mean, really, you know, you didn't plan or react appropriately or what have you. But, you know, there is something to that. And so it should be a tactical deficiency for spreading yourself out too much, right? And I know that sounds like rather obvious, but at the same time, like looking at the game and the concept of it, you tactically always want to be within mutually supporting range of yourself, mm-hmm. right? Your own units. And so when you consider this coherency, and you know, we won't get into the actual ranges and whatnot, like according to the game and so on and so forth. But when you look at it, man, like it's actually pretty cool the direction that they go. Like every model in coherency has to have two models within coherency of it in order for it to stay in the fight, because that one guy hanging off on the side, like especially you get to this whole morale concept and the abstractions to it, like he's going to have a really hard time out there by himself, and you just can't say what a stray deal or one thing, you know, one thing or another goes like that. I, you know what, I'd be interesting, and I'm just spitballing here. We have no grounds, no basis for this or whatsoever, but at this point, we've seen exceptions with special abilities and rules in a data sheet for just about everything. What if there's a new one that comes out that says these models don't have to have two models to be in coherency or whatever?
That would be, I think it's Unleashed Alliance for Custodes, where it says literally, this unit that was a unit is now no longer a unit. They're all individuals.
Exactly. There you go. So there is something, right? But like, you know, something like that. That's a great point. So very much so.
That's pretty interesting. It's like the buddy system when we used to visit museums and field trips for school.
Yeah, absolutely. Just on a tactical level, right?
Seriously, you're the 41st millennium, yeah? And all of a sudden, you're the first guy in the trail. Like, and you're not a Tyranid, so you're not like fearless. You're just a dude. You're just a guardsman. You're just Major Pal hanging on the end of the squad. You're like
Private Pal. He's over there first time dead. Out in the jungle. You know, he's
Man,
yeah. Horrible things happen in the 41st millennium. Horrible things can happen to the guy by himself.
I can't even pronounce its name.
So the Death Jester rules is death is not enough. If any models flee from a unit in the same turn that has been attacked by this model, then you can choose the first model that flees instead of your opponent choosing. God, can you imagine just the fun sponge? You could probably feel the air being sucked out of the room when you cause somebody's unit to just unravel because of this.
I think it's more than that. Just like the first time you do it to a guy, and then his next movement phase is going to be a completely different movement phase to the one he did before he found out what this rule does.
You're not kidding. So I mean, but that rule was basically just wallpaper before. Didn't matter. So much.
Yeah, it didn't matter. I mean, you got to pick off the plasma gun in the squad, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, you looked at a unit, and so like, you know, you're fighting the Xenos. They're spacing on me right now. I can't believe I'm doing this. The Space Marines. Gene Stealers.
GSC, you're picking out rock saws and.
Yeah, exactly. You're picking out that kind of stuff. Melta guns, thunder hammers, all that kind of stuff. But that was such like it was just a nice to have, right? And typically Death Jesters were cool guys to bring along with your detachment where you're really bringing the solitaire, right?
Yes.
Or something like that. Like that's really what it was. But now Death Jesters, we don't know point differences going into ninth, but why not, right? Like why wouldn't you?
Well, there's so many the formation, the one, and then the stratagems, the key off the Death Jester. And then this is pointing towards, you know, we talked, you know, how we think this may fit in the morale phase, but it seems like we may actually be building up towards a meaningful morale phase, which we have not really had, you know, we just haven't.
This entire edition. Like, I remember I started this edition playing 100, 120 to 180 fearless conscripts. I finished this edition playing 40 Tempestus Scions blobbed up around one guy who, for one CP, makes them all fearless. Like the morale phase just didn't matter. So I'm very happy with this. I'm really happy with the morale changes. I think even I said this a month ago. I said one change I'd like to see is a morale phase that actually matters.
Yeah, I think we're, you know, it's looking like we might actually have that. We'll see.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. Let's do that community spotlight segment, and then we'll come back with Red and Adam.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a very special community spotlight segment on Forge Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Tanya Gates.
Hello.
Charlotte Hamilton.
Hello.
And Jen Aspen.
Good job on the last name.
I do what I can. I'm not really a reader, but I try to.
Nobody ever gets that right. That was fabulous.
Everyone, y'all may recognize these folks. I wanted to have them on to talk about some, you know, let me just ask the question if I can. You folks play 40K, is that correct?
Yep, correct. Yep.
Outside of the pandemic, you know, I can imagine that means going out into game stores and stuff. How much courage does it take to enter a game store for the first time being a female?
I guess I'll tackle this one from my personal experience. I struggle with social anxiety. So for me, the first time going into a game store to actually play, I was terrified. Actually, the first time I went in and I didn't even bring my army in. I just went in and was like, am I going to do this today? And then I was like, nope, I'm not going to do this today. So I like walked around and I said hello to everybody and then I peaced out. And then the next time I came, I actually brought my army in and I played a game. But that those first few times actually were quite terrifying for me.
I had a very different experience. I grew up with a lot of guys. So when I went into the game store for the first time, I stood in the middle of the room and it was my husband who had taken me there. And we were there to pick an army. And I was looking at it going, nope, 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 that one. And started right away. I didn't have that kind of anxiety about going in the store. It wasn't till after I'd been there for a while that I learned that it was weird that I was there.
It's what was your first army that you picked?
Sadly, it was Sisters of Battle.
What do you mean, sadly? We're not friends anymore.
I never played them. We bought them. We got them home. We started painting, and my husband entered a tournament, and he needed something like 1,500 points of Blood Angels painted in 3 days. And after that, I didn't touch my sisters. Switched over to Fantasy for a while instead.
Good choice.
Came back eventually.
I think for me, my anxiety is rooted in some really poor experiences that I had online in Facebook groups and forums, which really sort of colored my expectations of what it would be like in the store as well. But I'm happy to say that those interactions that I had online were not indicative at all of what the culture was like actually in the store.
Yeah, that's kind of my next question is, have you seen the culture, you know, I guess start to be easier to interact with?
Yeah.
In my opinion, yes. It's changed a lot in just a few years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like normally when I go into a new store, a lot of times I just go in and kind of plop my shit down. It's like, this is my spot now. It helps that my main gaming store, one of the managers is a woman, so it's easier to go in and start talking to people that are there when there's, I don't know, representation on the staff aspect. Like for the record, I don't typically play 40K a lot. I am more into the lore and the narrative, but I will play Shadespire because, you know, I'm getting old and having massed armies isn't a thing for me anymore. I am struggling to paint my new Sisters of Battle box and they are my army. Like I got 2,200 points in metal sitting on my shelf.
Wow.
God, these new models are gorgeous.
Oh, are they ever? I am taking my time with those ones. I am not rushing them at all because they're my showpieces. I will never put them on a table. They will be just for show. And I've come to terms with this.
I think for me, it was a little, I mean, I had a different kind of transition than most females do, I find. And most people that are not the typical nerdy guy. I went from that very early, just jumped right in there, and my husband and I got playing and painting right away to being the assistant manager of the local GW. So then it was me pulling people in. And then when I moved over here to the mainland, I mean, I run a convention over here now. The guys, I go to any of the game stores and the owners are the sponsors of the event. So they're introducing me to people and things like that. So it very much has evolved and changed. I mean, it's not a big deal over here anymore when there's women coming around.
That's awesome. I mean, that's very, really, really encouraging to hear. I think that at least with some of the folks that I know is that they may just not know how to interact, like what, how to make it easier to interact and get in. You know, are there things that you may be able to tell them or to express here that they may be able to kind of take that knowledge and apply it the next time that the situation comes up?
I think the biggest thing I found when the guys were bringing girlfriends and spouses into the stores, I had to say, stop talking the lore. Stop talking all the rules and the dice stats and things like that, because most people that don't know the game don't know what the hell you're talking about.
It can get very overwhelming very fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Show them the models. Show them the, get them walking around. Introduce them to the social aspect of it. Then you can start working on the lore aspect and the dice aspect and the rules. It's very different when it's somebody coming in who's never seen it before or who's only experienced you at home.
For me, my experience is a little bit different as well, because I had an army at the time. I had been painting for a really long time. I had been into the lore. I had played a little bit in 7th, but only at my house and only with people that were my friends. So then going to the store was a whole new experience. So when I showed up, I actually already had an army. I already knew a lot of the background and stuff, but I had just not had the social experience. And I think if it was somebody like me who was coming into the store or the game group for the first time, bringing my army in, all it would really take to make me feel accepted would just be to have somebody come up and be like, oh, you have an army. Do you want to have a game? That's it. Like, not leaving it up to the new person coming in, but actually like an established member of the group coming up to that new person and extending a hand to welcome them in and treat them just like any other gamer who would otherwise be in the group already. For me, that would be like the biggest and best way to get me to come back.
Yeah.
So adding that personal touch, essentially customer service for the most part. You know, having people at the store who work there say, hey, what brings you in? I see you have a case. Are you here for a game? Well, we have a few people who are looking for games as well. Let me introduce you.
Like, I do believe that it should be staff who are introducing or extending that hand. But at the same time, I do think that people need to take ownership of their local game group and the culture that they are producing there in. And I think that it should be up to everybody in that core game group to be providing that customer service when it comes to bringing in new players. Like, if everybody takes ownership of the culture and everybody takes a leadership role within the group, I think there's no way that you could have a toxic gaming environment.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everyone should just kind of not be put off or hung up on the fact that it's a female or, you know, someone new in the store. They should just be ambassadors of the hobby the same way that we would all want to be treated.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
Because it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter what color your hair is, what you're wearing, who you are, what you are. The game is a game. No different than you sit down to play a board game with somebody. I wouldn't get anything different if I sat down to play Catan with somebody. Why should I get any different if I'm sitting down to play Warhammer?
Oh, no. You might not get any bricks. But nobody gets bricks. See, that's the secret.
Our family is super competitive with Catan.
Yeah, I avoid playing that here for that reason.
More competitive with Catan than we are with Warhammer.
Yep. Oof. That's serious funny. Business there.
No, I get it. I get it. That robber is no joke. And then who's got wheat?
Well, and I think the other thing that helps when you have somebody new coming into the hobby is don't pair them up with that guy, the guy who always has the worst lists or is the worst sportsman in the building. Make sure they're playing against somebody who can have some fun. Make sure they're playing against folks that, or near folks that get it, that they're new and that aren't there just to win. Because that makes a big difference for them too.
Yeah, that's a good point on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know one thing I hear quite often, like when I first got our basically like Women in Wargaming Discord server up and running, was that when our members would go into a store for the first time, or even if they've been there before, they feel very weird going in if they are the only person who is not of the major demographic, like if they're not male or male presenting. When we talk about being ambassadors for our own gaming group, I think it helps having people who make up the other demographics part of that group. Like not, I don't know how I want to say this, not only relying on the group to be full of guys and have the guys try and get people in, because depending on a person's experiences, they may not be okay to go into a group of all guys, just for whatever reason. Trying to get groups that have more regular variation in their demographic, I think, is a key part to being able to grow our groups and grow them in a in an inclusive manner.
That's an interesting point. You mentioned the Discord server. Tell me a little bit about that, and is it something that people could join if they wanted to?
Definitely. That's actually where I met Tanya. It was an idea I had with another wargaming woman last year. She is in Norway, I think. We connected through like the Reddit Warhammer Discord group. So we approached it from an angle of having a place where women, non-binary, gender fluid people could get together and talk about the games that they play. And we started it off as like a wargaming avenue, but then we grew it into other games like board games and card games and tabletop role-playing games, which is my real passion. So yeah, once we got the doors open and started advertising, we had people come in. And one of the first things I had them do in the group itself, like not just targeting separate people, is if they wanted to share their experiences of what it was like to get into wargaming in their local communities. While we are typically set up for women, whether they are cis or trans, non-binary or gender fluid, we still have an area for allies that want to join and want to talk the game. Because if we have an area just for us, we kind of get into an echo chamber. And doesn't matter who people are, people love to talk about the game. They love to share their painted miniatures. They like to share what they're doing on their terrain and even share like lore stories that they've been writing. I mean, at the end of this, I can give you the link if you want to put it in the show notes, if you have that sort of thing set up. It is open to anyone as long as they're not assholes. Part of the server is gated. So if you don't fall in the demographic that we have the server for, you only get to see a certain portion of it.
No, that's really cool.
Pretty much about it.
Jen, you mentioned a convention. Now, I mean, I don't know when that normally falls in the year, so maybe it's impacted this year, but tell me about it.
I started running Kippers in 2012, and it was really bizarre. I had just moved here, and the guy said, you know, there's only one convention on the island. You should run something, because you've run events for GW for years. And I went, yeah, maybe next year. And they said, no, run something this year. And I did. And I've been running it ever since. And we've gone from 18 guys in a very small room, and it was guys because I was the only female at that point, to last year we had over 80 players, five different game systems last year. We run every October, and it's been fantastic. The last couple of years, we've had a fellow in a wheelchair. And I tell you, I had never thought about having a player come in a wheelchair.
Is that Justin?
No.
Okay.
Now I'm drawing a blank on his name. But he does, I think he travels from the interior. He's an Age of Sigmar player.
Oh,
fantastic fellow. But because of the convention space that I use and the way I put everything in the room, I have space around every table. So he was able to get in and around without any problem. And he was really grateful for that. It's one of the few he's been to that he had no issues. We had a fellow at Wet Coast GT, which is one of the conventions that I go to, and they run, we have three of us that actually run in a championship circuit here in BC that was supposed to get up and running this year. And they have a deaf fellow who comes. And to see everybody rally around all of the different types of things that we can be faced with, whether it's somebody with severe anxiety, whether it's somebody who has autism or whatever, the community accepts. And I don't know that 15, 20 years ago, that it was as accepting. So I've really enjoyed running Kippers. We are running this year. Our convention center has told us we're good to go. So I anticipate we'll be filled to the rafters because we'll be one of the few events that'll have been able to run this year.
It's really encouraging to hear what you're talking about. And one of the kind of reoccurring themes on my show is that just the fact that you're there at a table playing the same game with the other human across from you means you probably have a lot in common already. You don't know it yet because you just met, but you probably have a lot in common, probably more than you have not in common. And it's worth figuring that out with them over the thing that you both have a passion about, which is happens to be this game.
I think the best part is after you play your tournament games in the day, everybody blows off the event and goes to the local pub and they talk and they laugh and they drink and they karaoke and they do whatever else. And it's all the same people and you all just circulate. Hey, I played you today. Hey, you played my buddy today. Nobody cares who you are or where you came from.
That's great to hear. Tanya, my colleague over on 40K Today.
Yes.
Where can people find you?
Yeah, so 40K Today. I am doing more and more on that podcast every day, it seems like. And then I also have a Instagram account where you can find a lot of my painted minis and you can follow my progress as I learn to be a less bad ITC player. And yeah, so you can find me there. It's instagram.com/@the.warmistress.
And one of these days, she's going to make it to Kipper. She keeps promising, but she hasn't made it yet.
Let me just do it on the podcast so that it's like a thing and people can hold me accountable. I will go to Kippers this year, whether I have to like hitch a ride with somebody from Kamloops or whatever. I will make it to Kippers this year.
That would be phenomenal.
Y'all are saying these place names like I should know where what it is. Like the island, the mainland, the wet coast. I can't even remember what you just said.
So I live on Vancouver Island, which is just off the west coast of BC. There's actually a ferry from Seattle that comes here as well as from the Vancouver area. And Tanya's on the interior of BC. So Kamloops is from where I am about 8 hours. I don't know. How far is it from you, Tanya?
It is about an hour and a half. Well, it depends how fast I drive, but an hour and a half to an hour 45.
And Kamloops is the other area that has one of BC's biggest gaming tournaments. And there's usually a crew of them that come over for Kippers every year. So that's why she can hitch a ride with some of them.
There you go.
Yeah.
I will put these things in the show notes so people can find them if they want more information. I really appreciate y'all coming and joining me.
No, anytime.
Thanks for having us, Paul.
Yeah, I would absolutely like to have you all on again, you know, to talk about these kind of things as, you know, just to get some awareness out there.
Well, you know where to find us now.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I would love to come back.
You'll have a great night.
You too. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, you as well. Paul.
Thank you.
FDN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Thanks for tuning in for that segment. Okay, we're still on this Gene Steeler cult article because there's so many things just sprinkled in there. I think this is written by our buddy Mike Brandt, and who may also be coming on the show pretty soon. So again, I'm not kidding about all this fantastic content we got coming. You're going to want to like, share, and subscribe if you haven't already.
I love how he's almost nonchalant in the way he just drops like A-bombs on the game.
So the here we go. We're talking about command points and stuff or whatever. It says, this combined with the extra command point per turn means that over the standard new edition game length of 5 battle rounds, you'll have at least 17, air quotes, command points in a game.
Just idle drop as we continue to talk about command points in Gene Steeler cults.
Yeah. So what do you guys think of that change? Like off the bat, gut feeling, like it, dislike it?
In an effort to speed the game up, maybe in an effort to compensate everyone meticulously placing their models so they don't get zapped with unit coherency rules. So maybe all these things combined to give us and then a shorter board space, which in my opinion, I've told you this, the shorter board space actually, I think, buys assault armies a turn. So it's like you've minused a turn from the game already. So I think we're going to get a lot of action. I mean, into the game. Like, some people say that the sixth turn in most games, you either don't get there or it's a nothing burger turn or whatever.
Right. But, well, and yeah, absolutely. And that, exactly to your point, Paul, in that the board's smaller, points are being relatively inflated, and we cut a turn out, like a lot more action is going to happen with in regards to what's happening. So I think it all works out by and large.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've already heard people saying, well, the fifth turn is going to become the new sixth turn. Like, whatever. No, it's going to, what this is doing is keeping, well, one, it may shorten the time it takes to play a full game of Warhammer. That remains to be seen. But what I think it does is that we get to the crescendo and peak of action or, you know, quicker in a game.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot more impetus in the game. Like, you can't, my usual tactic as a guard player, bubble out anybody who's got deep strikes until after turn three and then dominate. And I've still got half a game to dominate the board after turn three. Can't do it anymore. I have to move forward. I have to play a much more proactive game where I'm actively scoring for the first three turns and not just kind of treading water. So I think this is going to change a lot. I think the repercussions are going to be a lot more wide reaching than we think at the moment. The way people build lists is going to change, I think, fundamentally, just based off the turn, if not changed by anything else that comes out for ninth. On the whole, I think this is a good thing, especially for competitive play.
Yeah, number one, I also advocate burning your command points as fast as you can.
Said like a true Blood Angels player. Yeah, the only person who could say that louder than you was an orc player.
And so the concept of getting one back over the course of the period of turn, that's going to feel amazing to have this this steady drip of new gas coming into the tank.
I'm considering, I really want to paint some knights. I've wanted to paint some knights for a long time. And one of the reasons I feel like knights are going to feel good at the moment is that turn five, the last turn of the game, when you've got that one knight left on four wounds and he's got to do six things, you're always going to be able to make him operate on top profile of your Mechanicus, because you're always going to start and be like, bam, got that influx of that first CP, just like, hey, already like going from absolute, this guy was on his last legs, to we're fully operational battle station once again. So I like automatically just that feeling. Yeah, it feels like it invigorates the end of the game. You know, there's still things to do, meaningful choices to make. So many people have really, and I think Paul pointed this out a couple of weeks ago, so many more meaningful 1 CP stratagems, like pivotal game changer 1 CP stratagems now. It used to be 2 CP, 3 CP, that kind of stuff. But yeah, like getting that 1 CP turn five, turn four, when you could make some real impact with it, I think is very sexy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And something, and I, not to, to jump too far away from it, but I, you know, you asked our opinion on it. I will have to say, personally, at my most core level, and I know this is a little bit older school in approach to turns and length, and I don't disagree with five turns. I will say my personal preference, and you know, we were talking about the earlier in the show, we were talking about coherency and its relation to some of the real world elements. I actually didn't mind the old school elements of random turn length, because you don't ever really get to, unless you completely wipe the enemy out, you don't typically get to determine when and where or how the battle just stops.
When the fight's over. It's not up to you. If it was up to you, what a world that would be.
Exactly. Sorry,
Napoleon, exactly. We're done. We're going to keep our country in Spain stays in Spain.
Right. And so with that, right, I kind of appreciated the randomness to the fact that you always had to kind of brace for the turn ending or the turn continuing. And there was some unknown factor to that that you were still kind of trying to manage that was outside of even the other player, right? Like that was a game thing. But in the real world, so in going into this and having five turns or six turns, I don't think that it's a big deal. I think that, as we've already discussed, I don't think that five turns is necessarily taking away from anything versus what we had with six turns. I do think that it's completely explainable in its abstraction, in that this is a tactical fight, right? This is one piece of this massive, awesome campaign that your army is technically fighting in, right? Like, this is not the, I mean, maybe this is the last stand or what have you in certain cases. But it, for the most part, there's all these other actual operational factors that you only get so much time to determine how well you can do if you don't get wiped out completely or you don't wipe out the other force. And so I still think five turns is well within the realm of, well, the operational factors say we're calling it here. And if you haven't achieved the objectives, then you lost, and that's it. Mm-hmm. We move on. Just something to think about.
Yeah, I think I like that mentality of the fact that, you know, it's still a number of resources to manage. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting take on the random game length. I mean, I can think of times when it definitely added some suspense, but I don't know, man. It seemed to bite me more than it didn't.
Well, it's one dice roll, right? And that's tough sometimes when the entire game hinges on a dice roll of continuing or not. But that's also kind of a generalization to say that it's just the dice roll when technically it's tough. It's really tough to manage. Are you going to continue or not? Do you have the momentum? That's, again, you're fighting more of yourself in some cases than just the game in that or the other player in that regard.
Interesting. Adam, I thought you were going to bring up with the Knights of like strategic reserves.
Do you want me to launch into that? Have we got another 45 minutes?
We've got a few minutes, I'm talking about like, you know, we only know, you know, of course, what's so much right now, but things like, you know, Castellan coming in, on turn three, Mortarion coming in with some Terminators.
Yeah. So I love the idea of having Magnus and having Morty just like drop out of the sky and be like, I smite thee.
I know you've been beating on these plague bearers for, I don't know, an hour and a half, but hey.
Yeah. I've got this little premonition in my head that people should be afraid of Castellans again. And this is just based on it. Like most of my things that I say, it's just a gut feeling. But like a Castellan right now, especially with one of the new buffs in Psychic Awakening where you can give it a Warlord trait where it rolls an extra D6, discarding the lowest, discarding any of them that you please for its shots. And for those who don't know, that's both guns. So if you give him the plasma gun, the volcano lance, and then he's got the probably what you would take as the two shoulder mounted twin siege breakers, he's getting a lot of value from that. On top of that, if you're going to go all in on this, you probably go all in on it, make it House Raven. So when he comes in, he rerolls all his ones. So that means you roll 3d6 for the plasma for maybe what is going to be cause wrath, rerolling any ones on those dice. Roll to hit, hitting on threes, rerolling all your ones. Roll to wound, wounding everything in the game on a 3+ unless they're toughness 9, rerolling all your ones. And that just translates to so much value. And the issue, one of the big reasons the Castellan died off is because you couldn't maintain the CP necessary to make it bonkers. And on top of that, it went up by like 200 points. So that's no small thing either. But having it come up, like being safely off the board, don't need to rotate your shields. You know, it's not going to get shot. You walk on, and then if you can line it up properly, in one turn, you could possibly kill everything that can kill that Castellan. Just like it used to, because that's what it used to do, guys. You used to have a 3+ invulnerable save, and it would kill, and you couldn't kill it before it killed everything that could kill it. And now I feel like that equation might have returned.
Yeah, I've seen nothing that refutes that.
So one of the reasons I can say that with I suppose that premonition is based on the fact that I've got this feeling that most armies are going to be a single brigade or a single battalion, thereby meaning the amount of things you can take that are relevant against a Castellan are limited. Like, so you're limited to three things in your heavy supports that can kill a Castellan, like three Lehman Russes or three Basilisks, things like this.
Don't worry, and we have Eradicators.
We got it. All the other four variants that don't do anything. That's another way I'm coming at it from. Like things, I don't know if Shrewd Knights are going to be good, but I feel like their gatekeeper status is going to be elevated just simply by dint of how people might be leaning into list construction. So here's the thing, yeah? Paul. When you were thinking about, oh, how do I kill knights? You're like, oh, I just take 2 to 3 shield captains. But then if you're only taking a single battalion, you don't have any buffing characters. You don't have any synergy characters. And yeah, you've just got those, you know, you might run into a game where you're playing against Tau and the smash captains might not be as good as they were because they just get roast toasted on decent, you know, by SMS now, who knows what. So examples like that, things that I feel like needed their characters to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And I think the things that I focus in on the most for those is Space Wolves and Dark Angels. There's probably plenty of others. But I feel like they're going to have to come at the game in a different direction now. Maybe Grey Knights is another example of that as well. That's where I think the big polarizing gatekeeper stuff might get some more traction. But if they do, it's only going to be for like a small to relatively like small amount of time because we know G-Dub's going to adjust stuff as necessary.
Well, with this stuff, I mean, I don't know how, you know, what the tactical feasibility yet of putting that large of chunk of your army off table is going to be, you know, as far as like how you score progressive objectives. You know, could you potentially be boxed out or marginalized with what your opponent is doing in their movement phase and stuff? But I think it does give a new lease on life for some of these models that were you know, again, like Mortarion and Magnus. Magnus is an awesome model, and he's cool to see on the table, but you don't see him very as often as I think you probably would, because he's so, I mean, he's not really fragile, but practically in some situations, he becomes fragile.
Exactly right. And it was almost they had their 6-month heyday at the start of 8th edition, and then there was just this massive decline. Like, they just, those two models especially, I mean, Gilliman has risen and fallen probably in like 3 or 4 different waves of him being amazingly incredible and then average and then awesome again. But yeah, Magnus and Morty, they dropped off and they kind of stayed down. So just those awesome keystone, amazing models getting a new lease on life, I think is, I personally just love it.
And bear with me, indulge me for a second, Mauler Fiends.
Oh, man.
Why? Okay. I love the model. I love the rules. Well, I don't love the hit on 4+, but tell me more. Tell me more.
Well, Mauler Fiends with like Lord Discordant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you look at the total power level of the units, and that's how you determine how many CP you invest, and you might be able to put some of these things that, you know, right, lined up in a line across from the table, look kind of goofy. Like, well, I guess I'm killing that. Hey, thanks for putting it right there. I know you've made my decisions for me. I know exactly what to shoot at. My first turns are incredibly predictable just based off of the army choices that you made. And now you may be able to mix that up a little bit and also create that uncertainty and fear the same way that some of these deep striking or infiltrating or, you know, coming in from the table edge type reserves have done in the past. But now it's expanded the units you can do it with.
Yes. Yeah. Mauler Fiends, Venom Crawlers, Defilers.
I was about to say Defilers.
Blood Slaughterers.
For the love of God, give them a new model. But man, they're kind of a much more loving toolbox now. Like, they've got a good blast weapon in the battle cannon that can be, you know, six shots per turn. They've got the Scourge for a bunch of extra attacks. They've got the Claws for like heavy lifting anti-tank. They've got a lot going for them, being able to shoot into combat, all those other things as well.
I mean, the main thing I think they have going for them is maybe not being killed in turn one.
Exactly right. You might actually get to use it. Well, honestly, I didn't kill them turn one because I just, like, there's no point.
Fair enough.
You kill the Disco Lord turn one, then it's just hitting you on 4s and maybe 5s if you minus 1 to hit. And you just don't care about it. It just didn't do enough that you really sweated the model. Well, at least the stuff I played against. Yeah, people, the guys who would have brought Defilers in my meta, they brought like Derridaeos and Leviathans with Butcher Cannon arrays instead.
It's a solid choice.
That's a very good choice. It's a very good line choice.
But I do think that the context of how the game works and which the ability to, you know, the only the things that were on the data slate and how you deployed and stuff factored into what's good. And again, I just kind of want to take a look at this with fresh eyes, knowing what or the thrill of the unknown, or maybe getting some play out of things that, I mean, like the Plague Hulk, even, we're talking about Defilers and stuff like that. I mean, it was actually a pretty point efficient thing, had some decent rules, but again, it just dictated what your opponent did or could avoid it or whatever. And now, you know, maybe that's not going to be as easy.
I love a lot of these. I just love vehicles. I've always been a treadhead.
Well,
I
know when I said Eradicators a second ago, you probably thought about the Imperial Guard tank or the, what is this? Is it a Space Marine thing?
I thought the Imperial Guard tank, yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about the new Primaris squad with the Melter rifles.
Oh, I didn't even twig that they had the same name.
They're
sure Eradicator. Three Marines with a 24-inch Melter rifle that, when resolving an attack against a unit that is within half range, roll 2. Okay, so to get that. Total obliteration. In your shooting phase, you can declare this unit will only shoot a single target. If you do, select one target unit for this unit. Models in this unit can shoot twice this phase, but they can only shoot that enemy unit.
Yeah, so they do have the Lehman Russ. They have the Lehman Russ rule, except it's not under the
24-inch Melter rifle assault.
It just smells like Fire Dragon to me. I don't know. I'm just getting this whiff of Fire Dragon off these guys.
It's anybody your else? T5, 3+ armor save. So the thing that actually I think brings these guys into somewhat balance is that they have Gravis armor.
That we chatted about this. That is the leveling factor. If they didn't have Gravis armor, they'd be incredibly good. The fact they have Gravis armor actually holds them back. It makes them tougher to kill, but it makes your ability to use them and wield them harder. So I actually like that. If that was done on purpose by J-Dub to limit them from being possibly overpowered, very clever. Very, very clever.
I could see it now. These guys are going to look so beef. Oh, they got Gravis armor. I guess they can't go in impulsors now.
and like the rest of the universe just sighs of relief. You've been like, oh, thank God. Because you can move the repulsor and then get the guys out within melter range first turn of your entire board.
That would have been pretty bonkers. I mean, they're already bonkers. What I like about this is that there's flexibility here. I mean, who knows what their points are. They're 5 power level that we can see, but they have, you know, 1 shot, but it turns them into 2 shots. So they can threaten. Like if everyone goes and starts playing MSU and a bunch of 5-man, you know, 10-man units or whatever, these guys will put a pretty healthy chunk in a 5 or 10-man unit.
Yeah, no matter, name your 5-man, that's not going to get smashed.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they're assault weapons, they can move 5, so they have a 29-inch range that they can reach out and touch somebody. And I mean, and this and is not if they stand still. If they just shoot a single unit, which most times I think you're going to be doing anyway, that's 6 mm-hmm. shots coming out of 3 Marines.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways to play with that. Like the first thing that jumped into my friends' minds when we saw that it was Gravid Armor, they were like, oh, you just take him as Raven Guard, turn 1, infiltrate. Or like the other option is you outflank him, and then you give him +3 inches range through the custom traits. And you got your 27-inch melter gun that's coming on 5 inches. And yeah, you can pincer. You can just pincer at will, come in from each board edge and reach virtually the entire board.
They are assault weapons, so they can also advance.
Them. Exactly right. Like there's a lot of flexibility with this unit. And you know, I'll say it again, thank God they're Primaris armor. Sorry, Gravis armor. If they were in regular, if they were like Hellblasters, these guys would be off the chain, I think.
3 wounds apiece, toughness 5. We know they're going to be able to benefit from the new cover, line of sight blocking stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very pushed, must-watch unit.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure it's at that tier where you need to be quaking in your boots. But if I rocked up with, let's say, this knight list I'm possibly running, and I'm playing against Raven Guard and he's got 3 and it's a 3, or maybe there's 6-mans, like 2 6-mans, you're just like, oh, it's going to be a bad day, man. Which one of these knights am I giving up to the sacrificial lamb? Like, and let's pray I only have to give up 1.
You don't need to buff these guys at all, but it doesn't take, they benefit from the lieutenants or the captains you're taking anyway.
Anyway, yeah.
I mean, this is obviously, the points look like they're pretty nice for the bundle of wounds and armor that you get for these guys in the weapons. I think this is going to be a devastating unit. It's a little too on the nose, but it is going to be a powerhouse.
Yeah, agreed.
No, I'm looking forward to using them though.
I like the models as well. They remind me of older Skulls for some reason. I got some very old Cadians, some very old metal Cadians, and there's the melter gun. I think you probably still fly them on G-Dub. And when I look at these boys, I see that guy, and I'm like, ah, these are good lads, because they remind me of Cadians. Anything that reminds me of Cadia, you know, rest in peace. just good dudes, you know?
I'm with you. Well, folks, I think that's our show for this week. We're going to be, again, coming at you hard with this cool content. I hope y'all hang in here with us. Y'all got anything else to talk about before we wrap up for this one?
Ah, dude. There's,
I'm all good. Had a great time.
Do you reckon we could, like, there's an option out there, because I as soon as 9th edition launches, I wonder how much continuous content we could put out, like, of just us just nonstop talking about the stuff. How many hours do you reckon we could get?
We don't stop right now. What is 24 times infinity?
how long is a piece of string?
So, that's right. Yeah. Well, we'll see y'all guys real soon.
Sounds good.
Good night.
Puts baby in the corner.